My pleasure to introduce Jan Jurgens. I'm sorry, how do you pronounce your name?
Very good, yes. Jan Jurgens, but that's fine.
Okay. He's a professor of at the University of Technical University of Dortmund, chair of software engineering. He has previously worked at the University of Cambridge, where he has been a principal investigator in some projects funded, for example, by Microsoft Research Cambridge. He has published over 100 papers, research papers, and he currently, if I'm not mistaken, leads the group on software engineering for critical systems, where they focus on model-based development of critical software. And today he's going to tell us to talk about security certification in the presence of evolution, models versus code.
Yes, thanks a lot for the introduction, and of course also thank you very much indeed for the invitation to give this presentation, which I'm of course very glad to do. So yes, as you already said in the introduction, I will shortly present a couple of recent research results on the topic of security certification in the presence of evolution, and I will talk both about the model level as well as the code level in as part of our work on model-based secure software development. So, just a second. Yes. Okay, so what is software evolution about? We've all noticed by now that software is increasingly long-living, and we noticed that, for example, in the context of the year 2000 bug, because suddenly software was still alive and in use in the year 2000, for which its own developers never expected that to be the case, and who also, as you all know, unfortunately only planned for 2 digits for the year number because they never expected that the software to live as long. So that's just a very striking example for the fact that software is increasingly long-living, even longer living than its own developers expected. And at the same time, it's also continually subject to change. As is visualized here in this software life cycle, with an emphasis on security, you can see here that, for example, requirements can change, and even after the software is already being implemented or is already being used, requirements can still change at different parts of the software lifecycle. And then also the environment may change. For example, in the case of security guardrail software, the attacker model may change, and of course also this has an impact on the software. And of course you can continually find bugs in the software even after it's already in use, and these bugs have to be fixed, which is also a change that is continually taking place. And yeah, all of that taken together is called software evolution. And so the question is now, what is the challenge about this? Why is software evolution so challenging? The problem is that, strictly speaking, after each change of the software, you would really have to redo completely all of the software tests. And this is the complete regression test. And the reason is that you never know what might have been broken by the changes in the software, or even just the changes in the environment. And of course that would be very expensive to do that. It would mean basically that the maintenance costs of the software are a multiple of the original development costs, and this is what is somehow visualized in this graphic here. And these are really high costs, so again in the case of the year 2000 problem, it is estimated that this problem led to $600 billion of cost worldwide to fix that problem. So this is really a lot of money that we're talking about here. And this reason is, this is of course the reason why in practice, unfortunately, in many cases, regression tests are only insufficiently executed because it's so expensive. And this again, unfortunately, also has in many cases negative consequences. And there's just one spectacular example for that given here. namely the explosion of the rocket Ariane 5 in the year 96. And the reason for that problem was, in fact, that there was a missing regression test, because there was software from the earlier version of the rocket Ariane 4 was being reused in the new version of the rocket with the new hardware without performing sufficient regression tests. And this was really the reason why the whole rocket had to self-destruct, because it was not working correctly. And again, a lot of damage here, $370 million of damage. And all of that in this case because of missing regression tests. So you can really see that this is a real problem and a real expensive problem in progress. So yeah, what can we do about this? And this is basically the motivation for our work, is to try to integrate quality assurance as much as possible with evolution. And we would like to be able to reuse quality assurance results as far as possible after an evolution, in order to avoid the high costs which I mentioned on the last slide. So we would like to reuse the results of the verification that we did before the evolution in order to reduce those costs. But of course, you cannot just do that, because you have to make sure that it is actually valid to reuse those results, because it's never clear whether the changes actually preserved the requirements which you previously established using your quality assurance results, or whether the change actually destroys those requirements. So actually, you have to identify conditions under which you can be sure that a given evolution preserves the requirements that you previously verified and does not destroy them. So, and if you can establish such conditions, then you don't have to re-verify the system again, but you can just make sure that the given evolution satisfies those conditions on preservation of the requirements, and then basically you're done and you don't have to re-verify the complete software system again. And sometimes you still have to re-verify part of the system, but at least not the whole system, because at least for part of the system you can establish that this is not necessary. And the goal is even further, to also be able to carry out this kind of analysis before you actually perform the evolution, because you can then, if you use a model-based development approach, you can perform this analysis at the model level before you actually change the code. And on that level, you can decide whether it is in fact okay to carry out the evolution, because it does not destroy the security requirements, or whether this is not a good idea, because if you perform the evolution, then the system will be insecure and you don't want to make the effort to fix it again, and therefore you would rather look for another alternative for that evolution. And this is something you can do on the basis of the analysis at the model level before you actually change the actual system itself. So yeah, basically this is the motivation for the kind of work that I would like to present in this short talk. Now firstly, a couple of general remarks on the context of our approach that we're using, and on the basis of which we establish these results. So the general idea is a kind of model-based and software development approach, specifically targeted also to security critical systems. And this means basically that, well, as always in model-based development, you have models at the center of the development process. In our case, we're mainly working with UML models, but of course you could also use some other kind of notation or approach for the specification. And the idea is in our approach that you can then annotate the security properties that should be satisfied by the system as part of the UML model, using an extension of the UML called UMLSec, which allows you to do that. And we've developed tools which allow you then to automatically analyze the UML model against the security properties that you annotated in the model. So that way you can make sure that the system is secure, firstly at the design level, but of course then you also want to make sure that the actual code is secure and not only the model. And for that, for example, we've developed tools which allow you to generate test sequences from the model, which allow you to check that the code also satisfies the security properties. And alternatively, we've developed tools which allow you to perform a static analysis of the code against the security requirements that are contained in the model. So these are two complementary approaches, and as usual, the test sequence generation is much more easily scalable because you basically just generate tests and you can generate as much as you want. But it's not as comprehensive. You usually don't get a complete test coverage out of that. On the other hand, using static analysis, you can get a complete coverage of specific properties, but not in general all properties, but you can do that in a fully automated way. Then also for security critical systems, important are further configuration data, such as, for example, user permissions or firewall configurations. Therefore, we've also developed tools which allow you to generate this data from the models in a way that the security requirements are satisfied by construction. Alternatively, you can also verify them against the security properties contained in the model if you have the data given already and you don't want to generate it. And in the end, of course, you want to make sure that the running system is secure. And while to some degree, of course, you can make sure by checking the code and the configuration data, but there may always still be security requirements, security vulnerabilities which somehow creep in even though you have done all of these security checks. So it's a good idea also be able to monitor that the system satisfies the security properties at runtime. And for that, we've developed an approach which allows us to generate monitors from the models which check that the system actually satisfies the security properties at runtime. So that's basically the overall approach and the different techniques for security assurance. Now, evolution means that any part of this picture may change at any time, and at each point the question is whether this change now preserves the security properties that you already established using one of these techniques, or whether it in fact destroys the security properties. And yeah, so this is something I would like to briefly talk about in this presentation. So firstly, two slides with a short overview on different results that we've been working on, and then later I would like to focus on some of these results in a bit more detail. So firstly, we've looked at different design techniques and architecture principles which can help us in the case of evolution, and in each case the goal was to identify conditions under which using these techniques actually preserves security properties at the case of evolution. So for example, we considered the refinement of specifications. So you might wonder what this has to do with evolution. The point there is that using refinement, you can actually consider the different versions of the software that arise during the evolution as a refinement of one common abstract specification of the software. And then, if you then can make sure that the refinement relation actually preserves the security properties, then it's enough to check once and for all that the abstract specification satisfies the security properties, and you don't have to do that again for all of these versions. So this actually saves you quite a bit of work because you only have to perform the check once here, and if the refinement relation preserves the security properties, you don't have to do it again and again on these versions. Then secondly, we considered the applications of refactorings as a technique to change a system in a controllable way. So you have refactoring operations, for example, available as part of various software development environments such as Eclipse, for example, and for these kind of refactorings we considered conditions under which applying those refactorings actually preserves security properties. And also we considered application of design patterns and also as a technique which allows you to reduce the complexity of the system in the context of evolution. Then another thing we considered was the actual principle of modularization, which is another technique which allows you to deal with evolution, because using modularization you can try to limit the impact of change to a certain part of the system. And that way the goal is to be able to only re-verify those parts of the system which actually change, because by modularization you can then make sure that the overall system is still secure. But in each of these cases the question is whether these techniques actually preserve security properties, because this is not in generally the case, and you actually have to identify conditions under which this actually is the case. Yes, there's a question?
Could you explain a little bit more what you mean by security?
Yes, I will give some examples in the second half of the talk, which security properties. We will see some examples, but just as a general remark, while security properties mainly mean data security, properties such as confidentiality of data, integrity, authenticity, and there are also a couple of more more specific security properties. So generally security in the sense of data security properties. That answers the question.
So does that include integrity? Or
yes, in principle, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it also includes data integrity, yes. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other questions at this point? No? Okay. So this is, these are the techniques we considered. And the second slide with a brief overview in which situations we actually considered these. As I said, I will come back to some of these results in a bit more detail in the second part of the talk. But just as an overview, in the case of refinement, we actually developed a refinement relation which we could show to preserve security properties. And this is not obvious, as I will explain in more detail in the second half, because there are in fact refinement approaches which do not do that. In the case of refactoring and the application of design patterns, we identified conditions under which these actually preserve security properties. Again, this is not always the case, so you have to make sure that in fact they are preserved. And we considered modularization in different dimensions. So for example, in the sense of layering of architectural levels in the system, component-oriented, service-oriented architectures, and aspect-oriented development. And for each of these modularization techniques, we again identified conditions under which they actually preserve security properties. And on the basis of these results, we then developed an approach for evolution-based verification, which now allows us to perform a verification after an evolution without actually having to completely re-verify the whole system. But the goal is, as I said earlier, to only be forced to re-verify those parts of the system which really have to be re-verified. And the approach works as sketched on the slide. So the idea is that at the initial verification, the tool registers which parts of the system are in fact relevant for a given property. And of course, it's usually not the whole system which will be relevant. So that is already a way which allows you to reduce the amount of effort you have to perform for the re-verification after the evolution. And this information is then stored in the model, as you might call it something like proof-carrying models. And after the evolution is carried out, we can then actually compute the difference between the old and the new model. And there are tools available for that purpose, for example, by some colleagues in Germany, Udo Kelter, they developed a tool called ZDIF, which allows you to compute the difference between two models. And on the basis of this difference, we can then check whether the evolution that took place satisfies the conditions that we have identified, which make sure that the evolution actually preserves the security properties. And if that is the case, we are done, so the tool doesn't have to perform the re-verification again. More precisely, the tool only has to perform the re-verification if the part of the system that it's looking at was in fact relevant in the initial verification of the system. Secondly, it actually changed, and such that thirdly, the conditions on the preservation of the security properties by the evolution are not any way fulfilled. So only if all of these conditions are satisfied, the tool actually has to re-verify the model. And yeah, we implemented this approach in our tool support, and it turned out that this in fact led to a significant speed up compared to a complete re-verification of the whole system after the evolution. And yeah, so in this picture, this is shortly visualized. Firstly, the initial verification, then compute the differences, and in the end, we only have to re-verify the differences where this is really necessary. And yeah, then of course, as I said already, we want to make sure that not only the model is secure, but also the code. So the goal is now to extend this evolution-based re-verification also to the code level. And to be able to do that, we firstly need an approach for traceability of security properties between the model and the code level, which is actually preserved by evolution. So in order to be able to re-verify also the code efficiently after the evolution. And we developed such an approach which preserves that traceability at evolution on the basis of the observation that each kind of evolution can be reduced to adding and deleting system elements, as well as performing supporting refactoring operations. And so if you think about it, each kind of evolution can actually be expressed in a sequence of such changes. And this allowed us to develop an approach which gives us model code traceability of security properties that is preserved by evolution by making use of refactoring scripts in Eclipse. So on the basis of these refactoring scripts, we could actually support an approach which gives us this traceability in the context of evolution. And our extension of our tool infrastructure, which actually supports this now, is shortly visualized here on the slide. And then using this traceability, the goal is now to also be able to efficiently re-verify the code after an evolution. And on this slide, I give a short motivation for the kind of security weaknesses which we would like to be able to find using the kind of tools that we are developing here. And this was in fact a vulnerability that was detected a couple of years ago in the de facto standard implementation of the SSL protocol, namely the OpenSSL implementation. That implementation is structured in a way that you have a function which is used to check the validity of a signature that is transformed as part of the protocol. And the problem was that the implementation of OpenSSL had a vulnerability in the sense that in the case of a malformed certificate, the receiving protocol participant treated that certificate incorrectly because of a misunderstanding with respect to the return value as part of the C implementation. It turned out that the function who checked the malformedness of the certificate would return the value -1 if it's malformed. But the other part of the implementation which calls that function misinterpreted that return value in the sense that a malformed certificate actually now is treated as a good certificate. And of course, this makes the whole protocol implementation completely insecure because the attacker now only has to insert a malformed certificate in the protocol exchange. And of course, it's very easy to create a malformed certificate. And then the protocol will assume that this is a good certificate because of this bug in the implementation. Of course, this is a very serious vulnerability. And unfortunately, these kind of vulnerabilities occur surprisingly often. So earlier this year, there were also a series of vulnerabilities in the SSL implementation on the iPhone, for example, as well as the implementation GNU TLS, which actually had similar similar kind of weakness. And so the goal of our work was now to be able to detect these kind of weaknesses automatically. And to be able to do that, we firstly developed an approach for symbolic execution of the protocol implementation, which allows us to compile the implementation to a symbolic representation, which we can then analyze for the security properties at the model level. So the goal is using symbolic execution to bridge the gap between the implementation and the model level. So in this slide we see an example for a very simple protocol message. We see an example implementation for that message in the C language, and our symbolic execution now compiles this implementation to a logical, to a symbolic representation, which you can see here on this slide. And that way we can now get the link over to the model level, where in fact we can now perform our security analysis. This is shortly sketched on this slide. So the idea is to be able to link the model for the protocol to the implementation in a way which allows us to carry out the security analysis which we originally defined at the model level, now also at the code level, and in a way which is also performed at evolution time by making use of this traceability approach which I mentioned earlier. So I will shortly explain this at the end of this small example. Here you can you see a fragment of a UML sequence diagram which describes a small part of a cryptographic protocol. And the point is that in the specification you have a point where a certain message is received, for example containing a certificate in the protocol. And before the next message is sent out in the protocol, the specification says that a certain condition should be checked, for example that a certificate is in fact a valid certificate. And this is something we can firstly analyze at the model level, that this specification in fact satisfies the security properties that we want to have. And secondly, we can now also link the model level to the corresponding parts of the implementation level. So here you can see an extract of the control flow graph which was generated from the C implementation, and we can now, using the symbolic execution, we can for example identify the points in the implementation level where this message that is specified at the model level is in fact received at the implementation level. And secondly, also the point where the next message is sent out according to the protocol specification. And we can now then perform the security analysis at the code level by making sure that for each path between the points P and Q at the code level, there is in fact a point where the condition that was specified at the model level is in fact checked correctly at the code level as well. In order to find these kind of vulnerabilities such as the one that I mentioned on the previous slide. And this is now something which also works in the case of evolution by making use of this traceability approach which I mentioned earlier. This approach was also implemented in our tools and carried out in a couple of case studies where in fact we also found a couple of security flaws, including one at a smart metering system that was developed by Microsoft Research Cambridge. Okay, but the approach which I mentioned on the previous slide assumes that you have the source code available for the static analysis. And of course this is not always the case, so in case that you don't have the source code available but you still want to make sure that the software that is running on your system satisfies the security properties, we've developed another approach which allows you to monitor the security properties at runtime by generating security monitors from the specification model. And in fact, there was already a similar approach in the literature, namely the security automata developed by Fred Schneider, but these were not targeted at the case of evolution, so it's not clear how to use them in the case of evolution, and they were only developed for safety properties, which is a restricted class of security requirements. And so we developed a new approach which, in order to overcome those limitations, which in fact was based on the approach of runtime verification that was developed by other colleagues a couple of years earlier. And we, on the basis of that approach, we developed an approach which now also allows us to monitor security properties. And specifically, we can now formalize the security properties in linear temporal logic. And our approach allows us to generate monitors which then check those security properties at runtime and also in the case of evolution. And this also now works also for non-safety properties using our approach. And so the idea is, which is shortly visualized here, is that you firstly specify the property as temporal logic, and our approach generates the monitor which then checks the property at runtime. And again, we implemented this approach as part of our tool infrastructure and applied it in a couple of case studies, and it turned out that the overhead from the monitoring was in fact acceptable. And just a short bit more comments on this this approach which we developed. As I mentioned in the previous slide, we used a three-valued semantics for LTL here in order to be able to also monitor non-safety properties. And the idea here of that is that at each point of the execution of the system, you can distinguish three different possibilities with respect to monitoring as security properties. So firstly, it can be the case that you can already make sure that, or you can already establish that the system will always satisfy the security property during the remaining run of the system. So from this given point in time onwards, the given execution of the system will always satisfy the security property that you want to monitor. So there are some situations where you can already establish that at some point of the execution. The other possibility is, of course, that you, at some point in time, you can establish that the system will eventually violate the security property. And then, of course, there's this third case that at the given point in time, you can neither determine either of the first two possibilities. So these are basically the three different cases which you can have at a given point in time with respect to a specific execution of the system. And based on these three possibilities, we define this three-valued LTL semantics, and this also now allows us to monitor non-safety properties. And more precisely, we can now monitor Boolean combinations of safety and co-safety properties. This one, it should. That's a good question. It could be typo. I think it has to be for all. The interpretation is this: for all executions of the system with the given prefix. So we have a given point in time of the execution of the system, and the prefix is fixed, but you have a still a possibility of different remaining executions of the system. And this means that at the given point in time, you can already make the statement that all possibilities for further executions of the system from this point onwards will violate the security properties. So in fact, this is not a negation of the first one. So this is probably where your question comes from. But you have, in fact, three cases. So either at the given point in time, you can say that the system from this point onwards will always satisfy the security property no matter what's happening. The second option is that you can say from this point onwards the system will always violate the security property no matter what will happen. And the third possibility is that neither of the first two possibilities can already be established, and you just don't know. Either, depending on which path it will take, it might eventually satisfy the property, or it might eventually violate it, or maybe it alternates between the two. So does it answer the question? Okay, great. Okay, and then yes, so just a short example, specifically what I said about safety properties. So here we have now an example of a part, in fact, of the SSL specification, where it is said that at the end of the handshake phase of the protocol, the server side in the protocol should send out the finished message only after it has received the corresponding finished message from the client side, and the hash that is contained in that finished message from the client is in fact checked correctly by comparing it to the hash that was previously computed at the server side. And if these two conditions are satisfied, then the server should indeed send out the finished message. And yeah, this informal condition you can in fact formalize using LTL, as you can see there. In fact, yeah, firstly by making by referring to those two events that are mentioned there. So firstly, basically you have to formalize what the event finished actually means with respect to the execution semantics of your model, your specification model. Yeah, of course, there's a step in between where you have to define formally what finished means, but for time reasons, I will just skip this step here and we'll just assume that this event can somehow be formalized as an event as part of the LTL formalization. And similarly, you do this for the event equal, which represents the fact that the hash value was checked correctly at the server side. And then by making use of those formalized events, you can then firstly, the first of the two sentences can be formalized as the first of the two conjunctions in the LTL formula. Basically, yeah, this is exactly what is written up there, expressed in LTL by making use of these two events. And the second one, this is the second part which should also be satisfied, is just the second conjunction in the LTL formula. And this is now in fact not a safety property, so you cannot monitor it using security automata. But using our approach, because it's a Boolean combination of safety and co-safety properties, you can, in fact, firstly, you get an abstract automata, which is derived from this LTL formula. And this is then compiled to a monitor, which you can actually use to check the security property at runtime. Okay. Yeah, and we applied this in a couple of case studies again, for example, also at Java security library, the Java Secure Socket Extension. We considered several versions of that, as well as the open source re-implementation Jesse. And again, we found several weaknesses in the implementation, similar to that go-to-fail weakness, which I mentioned earlier. And it turned out that our approach, in fact, works for large evolutions, in fact, even for re-implementations. So yeah, in fact, from the evolution point of view, it also turned out that the approach actually works quite well. On this slide, you see a small fragment of the specification model for part of the a protocol that is implemented in this library, together with the experimental results for performing the refactoring operations that we have to do to apply this evolution-based verification between the different versions of the JSSE and also the re-implementation Jesse. So you can see different kinds of refactoring operations that were performed, and in each case the time measurements that were necessary to perform the refactorings, which you can see was in fact sufficiently performant. Okay, so so much for the overall overview. Now, in the last couple of minutes, I would now also like to go in a bit more technical details about some of the results. And yeah, to be able to do that, I firstly have to explain to you what I mean when I say that our tool can in fact verify a UML model for a security property. And yeah, so this basically works in three steps. Firstly, the tool has to compile the given UML model into a logical representation, which can then actually be verified against the security property. And this, in fact, includes behavioral UML models, because we also want to check that the system behavior also satisfies security properties, such as, for example, a state chart. The second step consists of compiling the annotated security property also to a formalization. And in a third step, we can then use a verification tool to verify the formalized system behavior against the formalized security property. And in this slide, I shortly sketched the first of these three steps at the hand of a small example. One small UML state chart, as you can see there. In fact, only a part of that state chart, namely just one transition. I will just explain how our tool compiles one transition into a logical formalization. And so the way this works is that firstly, the tool extracts the relevant information for that transition from the UML model, that information that the tool needs to perform this transformation. And this is just basically the relevant information for the transition, namely what is the source state of the transition, what is the message that is specified which should be received in order to fire the transition, what is the condition that has to be satisfied in order to execute the transition. And then there may be an action specified that should be executed when the transition is fired, and of course the transition has a target state. So these are the five relevant information that the tool needs to compile this transition into the logical formalization. And this formalization, the way this works is sketched in this formula here. So in general, independently from this example, for any transition you have this information given, and this is compiled into this implication, which basically means that firstly it is checked that the system is in fact in the source state of the transition in order to be able to execute it. Secondly, it is checked that the correct message is received, and thirdly, it is checked that the specified condition is satisfied. And if all of that is the case, then in fact the transition is executed, which means that part of this implication after the implication arrow is in fact now also becomes true, namely this is a formalization of the execution of the action, which of course also has to be defined separately. And secondly, the system actually is assigned to get into the target state of the transition. And down here you can see this at the end of this example transition. So firstly, for this transition, we have the source state of the transition, which is reflected here in this formula, which is an instantiation of the general formula for this transition. Then secondly, the message that is received, the condition that should be checked, and the action that is executed, as well as the target state of the transition. So this is basically how our tool automatically compiles the UML model into a logical representation, which can then be formally verified at the end of just one transition on this slide. And the next step is now that the tool also has to compile the security property into a logical formalization so that we can verify the formalized system behavior against the security property. And this is now explained at the end of one example security property, namely that of secure information flow. So this is a security property which intuitively means that there should be no information flow from confidential to non-confidential data in the system, and not even a partial or indirect information flow. And coming back to the earlier question, you can actually also use this approach to formalize integrity requirements, but on this slide I explain it for confidentiality. But you can also use this for integrity, then it all basically it works the other way around. But yeah, for time reasons, I only explain it for confidentiality here. And yeah, firstly, you can also formalize this security property again in a logical representation. And basically, the formalization works that you compare two different possible states in the system, which only differ in the confidential variables. And then if you execute the system further, one more steps in each of the two possible states, then the two resulting states should also only differ in the confidential variables. So it should not be possible for the attacker to observe two different states of the system, and which initially look the same to the attacker because they only differ in the confidential variables, and then to keep on observing the system at some later state to be able to distinguish these two states of the system to the attacker, because that way you would have an indirect and partial information flow from the confidential variables that were different in the first place to the differences that were observed later by the attacker. So basically, we want to make sure that if you have two system states that look the same to an attacker, then they should always still look the same to the attacker if you execute the system further. And in order to avoid that there is some indirect or partial information flow from confidential values in the system to the part of the system behavior that can actually be observed by the attacker. And property we can now formalize using the implication which you can see there by making use of an equivalence relation on system states which say that two states only differ in the confidential variables. Again, of course, you have to formally define this equivalence relation on the basis of the execution semantics of your model. But for time reasons, I have to leave this out here. And again, coming back to our example, here you can actually, again, we have the state chart which we saw on the previous slide, which is now extended with a bit more information on the model level. Firstly, we also have a very small class model here, which basically specifies that there is a attribute in the system, which is supposed to store the account balance in this customer account. And in fact, this attribute money is specified to be confidential using this UMLSEC annotation. And you also have various methods which you can use to read and write the account balance, and in fact also to read the current state of the system. So as you can see, there are two separate states in the system. Namely, after the account balance has reached a certain value, obviously the customer receives a special service, extra service, and whether this is already the case or not can be queried by making use of this method Rx, which returns true or false depending on whether the system is in the extra service state or not. And in fact, this method is now not specified as confidential using the UMLSEC annotations. And as I said already, using this method you can see whether the state is in the system is in the state extra service or not by receiving the return values true or false. Which basically means that, and this is information which can be observed by the attacker because the method is not specified as secret, so this is part of the publicly observable behavior. And that way you can get indirect information about whether the secret attribute money has a value greater than 1000 or not, because this is what it depends on whether you get a return value true or false. And that way, this property of no downflow, which is annotated using the UMLSEC stereotype, which is basically the secure information flow, is now in fact violated. And this This the tool can in fact check automatically by using this formalization which I showed up there, because initially the two states are in fact equivalent because they look the same to the attacker. But if the attacker then calls the method Rx and observes the return value, then the return values are not anymore equivalent because they are different and in a publicly observable way different. And this means that this equivalence is not anymore satisfied. So that, that way you can actually check automatically on the tool level that this security property is not satisfied in this small example model. So much for an explanation for how a tool automatically verifies security properties at a UML model. Now I would like to comment a bit more on some of these results which I mentioned earlier. For example, this problem of preservation of security properties under refinement. So actually you might actually expect that a behavior preserving refinement should also preserve security properties, but surprisingly enough this is not always the case, and this is the so-called refinement paradox that this sometimes doesn't work. And so you might wonder what can go wrong here. Again, we can have a look at our example state chart, which we've seen already. And we now consider this state chart as a refinement of a more abstract version of that state chart, where the method Rx returns not concrete values true and false, but instead it returns a randomly generated Boolean value. And this is a basically more abstract version of that state chart, which now satisfies the security property, because now the values that are returned do not anymore depend on whether the secret attribute money has a value greater than 1000 or not, because the returned values are spontaneously generated and therefore do not anymore depend on the attribute money. And so this sort of more abstract version of the state chart now satisfies secure information flow. But the version that we've seen earlier, as we have already seen, does not satisfy secure information flow. So if you view this state chart as a refinement of that more abstract version, then you have a situation where refinement does not preserve security properties. And if you think about this a little bit further, then you find you realize that the problem is that in this example we were mixing two kinds of non-iterism, namely the non-iterism in the sense of underspecification, which we actually want to reduce by refinement, and the non-iterism which you actually need at runtime in order to implement a certain security property. And if you mix these kind of non-iterisms and reduce them by refinement, then of course you have a problem with security. So our solution for that problem now consists of in fact distinguishing these two kinds of non-iterism at the model level already, and on the basis of that distinction we can now actually show that our refinement relation now in fact preserves security requirements. And of course we have to show this specifically for a given security property. In this result we see an example for such a result where we show this for the case of data secrecy. We have to show this on the basis of the used formal semantics for the fragment of UML that we're using here. And going back to the example of the previous slide, it now turns out that using our refinement relation, this is in fact not a refinement relation now. And secondly, with respect to modularization, which I mentioned earlier, we have the similar problem that security properties in general are not compositional. And you can also understand this at the end of our example state chart, which we already know, because you can view this state chart as consisting of two sub-state charts, which consists of each of the two states together with the corresponding transitions. So this is the one sub-state chart, and this is the other sub-state chart. And each of the two sub-state charts now, in fact, again, also satisfies secure information flow, because in each of the two substate charts you only have one return value for the method Rx, and therefore there can be no insecure information flow from the secret attribute money. But if you compose the two substate charts to the state chart as we already know, then this does not anymore satisfy the conformation flow. So this is an example for the situation where composition does not preserve security properties. And this raises the question whether we can identify conditions under which composition does in fact preserve security properties. So we've just seen that it's not always the case, but we would like to have conditions under which it is in fact the case that security is preserved under composition. Again, because we then want to exploit that that result in the case of an evolution-based re-verification. And yeah, we've developed a couple of results in that direction by making use of an approach for formalizing system properties called rely guarantee formalizations, which of course is a long-standing approach by developed, for example, by Cliff Jones and others a long time ago. And we, on the basis of this kind of formalization approach, we now apply this to security properties, and we investigated different kinds of scenarios for composition, such as the scenario which you can see there, where a component P1 is moderately decomposed into two interfaces D and U, and a component P2. And in this situation, we identified conditions on the interfaces D and U, which make sure that P2 satisfies the same security property of secrecy that was already satisfied by the component P1. Again, the proof was performed on the basis of the formal semantics. And going back to the above example, we can now actually show using this approach that it is not possible to securely compose the two substate charts which we've seen in the previous slide to the state chart which we've seen already. Okay, now to conclude the running example, coming back to the approach to for evolution-based verification, which I mentioned earlier, let's now consider the situation that the state chart which we've already seen is the result of changing a previous version of that state chart where the method Rx did not yet have any return values and which for that reason still satisfied secure information flow. So initially the tool at the initial verification, the tool registered that for example these two transitions are in fact relevant for satisfying the security property, and after the change, so now we have the state chart variant which we already know, where we now have the return values. After the change, we can compute the difference between the old and the new model using the tools available for that purpose. And in this simple example, it turned out that exactly those two transitions were changed. And then for the re-verification, our tool can now check that in fact whether these differences satisfy the condition on preservation of security properties under evolution or whether this is not the case. And in the case of secure information flow, this can be done particularly efficiently because, as we saw, this can be formalized using this implication. And if you think about it a little bit, you can distinguish eight cases to whether the system satisfies the pre and post condition of the implementation in the old respectively new model. And out of these eight case distinctions, for the evolution-based re-verification, the tool only has to consider two of them, and this gives us a significant speed up at each re-verification step. And the result, of course, as we know, is that the changed model now does not anymore satisfy the security property. Okay, so far for a couple of concrete technical results on technical level. Now to conclude, just a couple of slides for a wrap up. Firstly, validation. The correctness of the developed evolution-based re-verification we were able to establish on the basis of the used formal semantics. The completeness, you can understand that this is in fact complete because each evolution can be viewed as a sequence of deleting, modifying, and addition of system elements, and the evolution-based verification is in fact applicable to all of these steps. And in practice, however, at the practical experiments, it turned out that the performance gain is maximal when the amount of differences is relatively small compared to the overall size of the software. Of course, if you have so many differences that the changed version of the software has nothing in common anymore with the original version of the software, then obviously you can you have to completely verify the new version of the software. So in that situation, an evolution-based verification is not going to buy you anything. But in this situation, in fact, it turned out that the evolution-based verification led to a significant speed-up. So here you can see an experiment for a particular security property, and there the complete verification had a performance exponential in the software size, even for a given constant size of differences between the old and the new model. And in this logarithmic scale, this is the red straight line in the middle there. In comparison, the evolution-based verification had a performance linear in the software size, which is the blue line at the bottom there. So you have a significant speed up in that situation. And you might wonder whether this is in fact satisfied in practice, and this is in fact the case. For example, in the case of maintenance of stable software versions, when you do a verification there, and this visualization of the different versions of the Linux software kernel, these are the horizontal branches in this visualization of the different software versions. So this is a situation which in fact occurs quite often. Or second situation is where you have verification integrated with the development, for example, in the case of verifying as part of the nightly builds of the software. In that case, you also have usually amount of differences that is small compared to the software size. Okay, then second, almost last slide, just a brief hint to some current work that we're performing also in further in this direction. This is a project which we're currently working on further in the context of evolution-based verification and security. And what we are considering here is now not anymore just that the system itself might change, but the knowledge about the security overall changes. So, for example, it might turn out that suddenly a certain security mechanism becomes insecure because a vulnerability suddenly becomes known. And the question is, how can you react to this change in the security knowledge? So, of course, strictly speaking, the system was already insecure before your knowledge changed, but simply no one knew that there was a vulnerability. And the question is how to deal with this situation that suddenly everyone knows, including the attacker and who might attack the system. Okay, so now think about just over with time. So just last question, last slide. Short overview, basically in this talk I presented a couple of results that we've been working on in the context of software evolution and with a goal to provide conditions which allow you to perform an evolution-based re-verification for security properties after the software was under evolution. And I presented a couple of results at the model level as well as the code level, and also an approach which allows us to get model code traceability of the security properties which is preserved evolution. And we implemented these different results, and it turned out that the evolution-based verification in fact led to a significant speed-up. At the moment, I already mentioned in the previous slide a project that we're working on. The second project we're working on is that we're now applying this approach to the case of cloud computing environments. Okay, thank you. Thank you very much again for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any further questions.
So, a question with regard to legacy software. Mm-hmm. So does your approach require that you put in your framework from the very beginning, or can you take existing or legacy software and work your magic?
Yes, that's a good question. So I think basically I should refer to this picture here. In fact, it is of course a very a very good question, because even though there's a lot of talk about model-based development, if you look at practice, of course, not every project really uses model-based development, especially not at a full scale. I mean, many projects use UML to some extent, but many of them only rather informally. So in this, in fact, is, raises the question that you just mentioned. Can you also apply this work to projects where software was not developed in a model-based way? And the answer is the reason why you have this picture, which consists of different modules, is in fact motivated exactly by this question. So we would like to be able, and in fact we are able to use these different parts of the approach independently. So even in a situation where we have the system and the source code, which was not developed in a model-based way, we can still use the approach. But of course, if we want to generate test sequences from models, then we still need models. But what we can still do is, as you can also see here, to extract models by using tools for reverse engineering. So if you have the source code available, there are tools which allow you to generate models from that source code. And we can then analyze those models against the security properties, for example. And so basically, the answer is yes. You can use several parts of the approach also in a situation where you have legacy code which was not developed in the model-based way. But of course, if you want to use models, you firstly somehow have to either extract them from the source code using tools for the purpose, or you might have to manually add them later. But it's still possible to do that for software which was not developed in a model-based way. Yes.
I'm not aware of tools that generate models. What kinds of models?
So of course there can be a very huge variety of models. And depending on what you mean by models, starting on a very basic level, control flow graphs, for example, and I showed an example on this slide earlier where I talked about the static analysis application. A control flow graph basically is also a model. In fact, it looks like some kind of state machine, but of course it's a very low level model because basically the code is transferred line by line to different states in the state machine. So that's a very, very basic example for a tool which allows you to extract a model from the code, which, because it's still at a low level, it helps you to some degree, but you would like to actually have models at a higher level of abstraction, and there are some UML tools which can actually do that. I think the UML tool Together allows you, for example, to generate sequence diagrams from the code level, and they also, I think it also has extensions which allow you to generate state charts. But of course the problem is always that the models that are generated are in many cases at a relatively low level on abstraction, and you would actually like to have models at a higher level of abstraction. So I think in fact there are still a lot of work that needs to be done on that end, which would be very interesting for the result in, research effect. Yes.
When you mentioned some slide about computationality, that
yes.
This was only in some cases. Could you give an example of a case where computationality can be used for security purposes?
So from our point of view, basically we're interested in compositionality, for example, because the context of evolution, because if you have a security property where you can say that for the given evolution it is you can compose the system into parts where the security property is in fact compositional, then this means that if one part of the system changes, you only have to re-verify that part of the system and you don't have to consider the rest, because you can then by a compositional argument you can be sure that the whole system is still secure. So a concrete example, well, for example, in the case of the security properties, security protocol, I gave an example for that. You usually have different parts, different participants in the protocol, a client and the server, for example. If you can then verify that in a compositional way, then this means that you can change the client and you only have to re-verify the client to make sure that it satisfies its own security properties, and you don't have to also consider again the server side. So that would be a concrete example where it would be very useful to have a security property which is in fact composable. Yes.
Just
yes.
the property may change in the runtime of the system, so that at a specific point, for example, you have a peak in the workload and you have somehow to deal with the runtime changes?
Yes, okay, you mean, so in this picture, if not the models or the system changes, but the security requirements.
The runtime system would change, so that we react to some changes that happen at runtime, so that also some of the models and the
software. Yes, so you mean if the requirements change or the system change, or both?
The system
or both.
Change, so as far as the system will change at runtime, does then the security property should reflect or trace these changes according in the specification also?
Yes, so yeah, exactly. So if the system in fact changes, then the monitor would have to also adjust to those changes and to make sure that the security property is still satisfied. And yes, and in fact this this also places a performance burden on the monitoring at that site, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yes.
Questions?
Okay, yeah,
thank
thanks
you.
A lot. Thank you.